Support for WPR comes from UW Stevens Point, offering an online Master of Music Education degree with graduate certificates in conducting, theory, and history. uwsp.edu/mme. Support for WPR comes from the Woodson Art Museum in Wausau, with Survival of the Fittest, featuring wildlife paintings by 19th and 20th century painters, now through February 23rd. lywam.org.
Great to have you with us on WPR. Larry Mueller here, and we've got, I think, a great show for you today. We're going to take a look at the year for you, and we're going to talk about improving your health in the new year, one with optimism, one with informed alcohol use, and another with synced circadian rhythms. And we're going to start today by focusing on how you can stay optimistic during the winter months with our guest, Dr. Shyla Merghain. She's a distinguished psychologist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. She specializes in using mind-body medicine to treat mood and anxiety disorders. She looks at injury, rehabilitation, and more with athletes. Dr. Merghain is also a sports psychologist to UW Badger student athletes. And as always, she has some great advice for us for staying positive during these darker winter months. And I want you to join in as we move along today. Let us know how you find hope when the weather's cold and the days are short. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dr. Shyla Merghain, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
So great to be here. Thanks for having me, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. What are some of the common mental health challenges people face during the winter months?
Well, so many people can have the winter blues, and a subset of those folks can fall into seasonal affective disorder. I also think there's a lot of uncertainty in our country. Just hearing that news update, that can cause some anxiety and distress. And I think it's very easy to fall into a rut, to feel lower motivation, to give up on those New Year's resolutions. And choosing to stay optimistic is really a skill needed to help us cope with stress in our lives and stay resilient during these uncertain times.
Yeah. And I was thinking about the holidays. The holidays can affect our mental health both positively, but also negatively as well.
Absolutely. A lot of people might be facing financial stress from overspending or just feeling a little unsettled after a recent conflict with family members. Or I know, like myself, it's just fatigue of having had a very hectic holiday time and then feeling like, oh, you know, you're needing some extra rest. And so I think all of that can feel like a pressure cooker. And as a result, I think people can experience lower mood and maybe also get into a place of pessimism. And we know there are health consequences if we get into that pessimistic stance.
From a psychology standpoint, what's the difference between optimists and pessimists?
This is such a great question, Larry. Optimists really externalize adversity, those challenges. They see them as fleeting, things that can be remedied, and they're specific. And setbacks are just simply mistakes that people can learn from. We also find, as a result of that mindset, optimists handle stress better, and they're much quicker to get over setbacks. And I love this differentiation, too, that optimists tend to credit good events to personal, permanent, pervasive causes versus those pessimists can think that, oh, you know, if I have this bad thing happen, it's going to plague me forever and it's because of something I did. And they're not necessarily, as a result, that can be a predictor of depression because pessimists feel less control. While optimists tend to exaggerate the control they have over events.
I was thinking about my own situation. You know, a couple of years back, it started with some health issues with my siblings. And I was asked to take a much larger and, quite honestly, unexpected role in their care. And so I was feeling, I don't know, sorry for myself or whatever. And then I realized, wait a minute, you're the healthy one. You're the one who has the ability to help. And that, once I came to that, I felt a lot better. And I think I performed a bit better, too.
I love that. And I think optimism and hope go hand in hand. And I think that's a wonderful example of showing when we can get into that optimist can-do mindset, we might be better at assessing the situation. We'll have more clarity of thought to problem solve what we can do. And it really gets us back in the driver's seat.
Yeah. I guess there are some health benefits, as you were kind of talking about, some health benefits of being an optimist versus being a pessimist.
Yeah. I think this is really powerful. Again, it's an effective tool for dealing with stress and anxiety. But more specifically, research has found that optimists catch fewer infectious diseases than pessimists do. They also have better health habits. And we know our immune system may work better when we're optimistic because we are experiencing less stress and less sympathetic activation in the body. And there's some evidence that suggests that optimists live longer than pessimists. So again, we think about it as optimism as a skill we can all practice.
You know, and just saying, well, think positive thoughts, you know, and that's a lot easier said than it is done. How do you shift your thinking to avoid negative self-talk?
Great. This really gets at the heart of it. And I think it's important to note we don't have to be overly positive, Pollyanna-ish, because there can be some negative to that because it can be realistic. But we're really looking at the wisdom of finding balance and trying not to really catch ourselves, to try to catch ourselves when we're catastrophizing, thinking the worst, when our mind gets hooked in those worst case scenarios. And remember, we always have a choice about how we think about a situation. And that power of choice, I think, is really part of our inner freedom. So if we find ourselves going to worst case scenario, if we find ourselves catastrophizing, you can imagine a stop sign or say the word stop or clap your hands stop to kind of reboot. And think about reframing the situation, thinking about what can I do? What support can I have? What might be a best case scenario instead of worst case scenario? What is a next step that I can take to help me resolve this? And again, we don't know the future. I think a lot of people are feeling doom and gloom about the future. I've seen that, 2025, it hasn't gone well so far. And I think we can't predict the future. So focus again on just one small thing that we can do to improve our lives. And again, it's a choice to have hope for the future. It's a choice to think optimistically about things that will go. I know my mom always has a wonderful saying, in the end, it'll be okay. And if it's not okay, it's simply not the end. And I know I will repeat that one to keep that optimism alive in my own life when I'm in challenging times.
Dr. Shyla Morgain, our guest, distinguished psychologist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at UW-Madison's School of Medicine and Public Health. You want to chime in? The number to call, 800-642-1234, or you could email us to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News, taking a look at improving your health in the new year with optimism. And our guest, Dr. Shyla Morgain, it's great to have her back from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And experience to share a question, give a call. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. Dennis emailed, and I think he's talking about what you were just visiting with us about. His comment, should people incrementally focus on one rung above their current frustration and depression? Incremental improvement might indicate more increments are possible and worth the effort.
Absolutely. You don't want to feel overwhelmed by working on this, but instead, I think even a simple question when we're working with our thinking is, we identify maybe that negative thought and thinking, is this thought bringing me peace of mind? Is this thought helping? Is this thought making me more hopeful? If not, we could chuck that thought out and then think about what thought would make me feel better in this moment, what thought would feel more helpful, what thought is more realistic, what thought is maybe focusing on the silver lining or what could go right in the situation.
Yeah. And you, in passing, you mentioned decatastrophizing. That's a term. Is that what you just described for us, or what does that term mean?
Absolutely. Research shows that when people are catastrophizing, doom and gloom, worst-case scenarios, they don't do as well. For example, people with chronic pain who are tracked over time that catastrophize, over time they have more pain, lower functioning, and greater suffering. And I think when we're catastrophizing, it is a lot of unnecessary suffering in our lives. It's not helpful. So to decatastrophize, it's like these thoughts have us on a hook, and we're flailing around like a fish on a hook, but we forget that the hook is barbless. So you can even label it, oh, there's a catastrophizing thought. We could think again, what is a more realistic thought? What is a more helpful thought? What thought would bring me peace? Or even, what would I say to a friend going through this? And my sense is that might help you come up with a more helpful, balanced thought, encouraging thought, to think about, yeah, how you can carry on and really give you that sense of hope that you need.
Vivian in Green Bay has something for us, so let's go there. Vivian, hi. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
I'm a pretty resilient, level-headed person, but last Friday I got some financial news that sort of put me in a fight-or-flight anxiety state, you know, where if I had alcohol or if I'd been able to just go to bed and cry. But I know I have to distract myself. The optimism part is hard to bring out sometimes. But so occupational therapy, find something to do, even something very rote, and let your mind drift a little. Sometimes just doing that, solutions will present themselves. You know, you don't have to solve the problem immediately.
Yeah. Vivian, thanks for calling. What about Vivian's comments, Shyla?
Yeah, Vivian, and I'm so sorry to hear about that financial news, and you're certainly not alone in some of those financial struggles, but wonderful to hear about your resilience and the strategies you're using to keep optimism and hope alive. And you're speaking about behaviors and engaging in distraction. I always am encouraging people to try to do one thing that will spark joy, one pleasant activity that will bring a smile to your face, that will bring a pleasurable experience, and it can be free. It can just be outside looking at nature or calling a friend or even treating yourself to something. And I think when we can do that, it puts us back in control, that challenge, especially with a long-term challenge. Larry, you're talking about health issues and families. Like, that doesn't get fixed overnight. Financial struggles, sometimes that can take a long time to fix, but it can. But in the process, making sure you're infusing yourself with things that really light up your spirit. And sometimes that's the first thing to go, but the most important thing to include.
Yeah. You use something called the SOAR practice to deal with uncertainty in life. Tell us more about that practice.
Yeah, I think the SOAR practice is a powerful one. It's a mindfulness practice we can use to get into the moment, to connect back with ourselves, and to allow more of life to come in. When we're in that place of pessimism or doom and gloom, catastrophizing, we get tunnel vision, focusing on what's wrong, and our mind can get stuck there. The SOAR practice is an acronym. S stands for, and people could even do this while I'm talking, so you might think of a recent small challenge, and then let's SOAR. So S stands for stop, pause, and connect with your breath. And you might just take one deep cleansing breath, so the stop for SOAR. The second is open. open up and soften in the body. Often when we're going through challenging times, we tend to clenching the body, clenching the jaw, clenching the teeth, and just see if you can relax the body, relax the jaw, the tongue, and even the back of the tongue can help ground us back in the inner body. The A stands for awareness of the moment without judgment or identification. So just aware of the moment as it is, trying to get out of judgmental mind. And after we stop to open up and soften the body, awareness of the moment, then the last is R, respond from this deeper, grounded place. And I think that practice, soar, stop, open, awareness, and respond, can allow us to get out of our head into the body, back in touch with our own innate capacities, and have a much more effective response versus just reactivity.
You know what? I tried that. Well, you were describing it. It does feel good to stop and pause and take a deep breath and soften up your body, become aware of the moment, which at the moment I'm on a radio show, so I better keep going. and respond. So that's a great way to look at it. And I'm wondering about is this what you use in the winter, the strategy?
Definitely. You know, I think it's good to have different mindfulness practices that can tap us into the here and now instead of that doom and gloom negative thinking. There are kind of many blessings around us that we take for granted. And I think when we're thinking about cultivating optimism, it's so important to, when we're going through challenging times or winter weather in Wisconsin, to get in touch with a larger sense of meaning of what's important to us, our own values, who we strive to be in the world. And when we think about kind of what is helping us get through, who we are becoming in the process, and even our ripple effect, what we are, that legacy, what we're going to leave behind, then all of a sudden, I think it helps us maybe see a larger perspective to a challenge we're going through. And it allows us to think about there's a lot I can change. There's a lot I can contribute. There is meaning in this. And that, I think, can be really powerful to keep our focus on staying positive in the times to come.
Yeah. Well, it's plenty cold outside this morning at about 20 to 6. I went out for my morning couple mile, 3 miles sometimes, but not this morning. Sort of jog walk around the neighborhood, and it's cold, but and I it's hard to get up and get out there sometimes during the winter, but I find it useful to get outside and do some exercise.
Yeah, I don't blame you. This morning driving to work, it was 1 degree, and it was pretty cool to be out there. But I think you're bringing up a great point, Larry, and thank you for mentioning this, that, you know, moving your body, right? If you're feeling stuck, if you're feeling down, we know movement, especially walking, can be a great natural antidepressant. And when people are stuck, getting some sort of physical activity can help feel that sense of flow again and can bring new ideas and new perspectives. And in the winter, we do become a lot very sedentary. Earlier today, I gave somebody the encouragement to just go to the grocery store and walk a few extra laps while you're grocery shopping to get a little movement in if you don't feel like you want to get out on these cold, snowy, slippery days. But even just walking around your house or going up and down some stairs can really do wonders, I think. And we know exercise, again, great mood booster, but also can help us stay resilient in the times of stress.
Yeah. I think in this time of the year, too, when it's cold and we're in our homes, relationships can become, well, either strained for those you're in the home with, or if you're by yourself, kind of getting away from those relationships because it's maybe too cold to go out and see somebody. How important are these relationships with others during these winter months?
Great. I think it's twofold. We can have cabin fever and start to get irritable with our loved ones if we're at home all together and not getting out. But I also find that for many people, they feel an increase in loneliness and isolation because they're not getting out and seeing people, or people aren't meeting up for plans. So I think social support is very protective of against depression. It's really important to have people in our lives that support you, that you can talk with in a vulnerable way about what those challenges are, can give you some different perspectives on how to handle things, some new ideas, or just be a cheerleader to encourage you to keep going. And, you know, this time of year, maybe it's good to try to get out with the loved ones or take a little break if you find you're kind of feeling too cooped up. I always say good fences make good relationships, so we need a little bit of spaciousness in there. But if you do feel like you're isolated, make an effort to reach out to somebody, even if it's just a call, to stay connected.
How can you tell if you just have the winter blues or cabin fever, or if you might need care for clinical depression?
Yeah, that's a great question. That if you find that your mood is so down that it's down most of the day, nearly every day for at least 2 weeks, or you are experiencing loss of interest or pleasure in things that you typically enjoy for most of the day, nearly every day for at least 2 weeks. And if you're noticing your mood is impacting your relationships or just functioning, like at work or at school, all of those are indicators that you might be in a clinical depression. And then don't hesitate to reach out to your doctor. You could see a behavioral health specialist. Medication can be helpful for certainly more severe depression. And I think a real key is early intervention is so important at helping depression remit.
Just remembering, we did a show on seasonal affective disorder on November 18th. If someone wants more information on that, go to talk@WPR.org or WPR.org/Larry. And the November 18th date, we talked about seasonal affective disorder. So a little more information on that. Shyla, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking some time to be with us today. I appreciate it and look forward to another visit.
Oh, thank you so much. Happy New Year. Appreciate being here.
Happy New Year to you. Dr. Shyla Mergane, our guest today. Great to have her with us. She is a distinguished psychologist in the Department of Orthopedics and Rehabilitation at the UW-Madison School of Medicine and Public Health. And just a note, and I'm just looking around here in my papers for something, if you or someone you know is struggling with mental health, don't forget that hotline. It's 988. That's the number, 988. That is our suicide and crisis lifeline, we call it. Don't hesitate to use it, 988. Coming up, we're going to talk about how drinking alcohol affects your body in dry January. And at noon, we'll talk about living in sync with your circadian rhythm. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Reducing the amount of alcohol you drink can heal many systems in your body. You might see improvements in your mood, in your sleep, in your immune system. Larry Mueller, and today on the show we're talking about health effects of drinking alcohol, and we'll also hear how excessive alcohol use negatively affects our Wisconsin communities. And a great guest for you, Maureen Bozalaki, is director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. And as we talk with her, I hope you'll join in. I want to hear from you. Have you been reconsidering your relationship to alcohol? How often do you drink? How much do you notice it impacts your health? Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk at WPR.org. That's talk at WPR.org. Maureen, great to have you with us. Thanks for joining in today.
Thank you for having me.
Earlier this month, the U.S. Surgeon General released a new advisory concerning alcohol and cancer. Just to begin this segment, what did it say?
It said quite a bit. And for those of us who've been in the field a while, this was not necessarily new news. This is something that we've known, the association of cancer and alcohol, for a couple of decades at least. But basically, he outlined, the risks of alcohol and cancer. He points out 7 different types of cancer: mouth, throat, voice box, esophagus, breast, liver, and colon and rectum. And there are many, he also points out the mechanisms of what alcohol does when you drink it, which I think is really helpful. There's a great report. I'm sure we can share the link with folks. And then that the higher alcohol consumption increases alcohol-related cancer risk in both men and women. So for those of us who really don't want to go through cancer, reducing or eliminating alcohol from your diet can be a big help with that. And I think the big shocker for a lot of folks is that it increases breast cancer risk in women.
Wow. That's a lot. And I, Claire just let me know, our producer, that we do have a link to the report on our page. So talk at WPR.org/Larry in today's date. And we have that link posted there. So, man, do we know how much we should limit our alcohol intake? In other words, is one drink a week okay, or one drink a day, or one drink a month?
That's a great question. So our current guidelines are in the process of being updated. So if you look at the United States guidelines currently, they say, one drink per day for women and up to 2 drinks per day for men. But also that is also considered heavy drinking if you drink every day.
I was going to say, that seems like a lot, actually.
Yes. So it's important not to drink every day, I think, is one message. The other message is you can't save it up. So if you want to, have some drinks over the weekend, by not drinking during the week, your body will still react to alcohol. It's not really recommended to drink more than 1 or 2 a day. And we've also found, and in this report, that even drinking that much does increase your cancer risk. So if you really want to eliminate that cancer risk, that's where you really have to reconsider how much you're drinking. In terms of guidelines, if we look internationally, Canada recently redid their guidelines. And they recommend no more than 2 drinks a week.
Okay.
So this is Wisconsin, so I know that would be hard for a lot of folks to really get their head around. But I think it's somewhere between what we currently have and where Canada is in terms of, reducing your cancer risk, as well as many other risks that come with drinking alcohol.
I read recently, I think it was the Washington Post, that alcohol consumption among younger folks in the country has gone down over time.
Yes.
Is that true?
That is correct. Millennials are drinking less. And so if you look at the age spectrum, the drinking kind of goes up with those in their 50s and 60s and beyond. And in Wisconsin, we kind of drink through the lifespan. But we are seeing trends where our 20 and 30-year-olds in particular are drinking less. And they're much more likely to participate in Dry January than folks who are older. So I thought those numbers were really interesting, that we are seeing our younger people that are drinking less and are you know, I think pushing some of the other alternative drinks and non-alcoholic beverages or mocktails as an alternative.
Yeah. What's been the response, as long as you mentioned Dry January? Let's talk about that for a minute. What, some people take part in it. They don't drink alcohol for the month. How successful is that in your mind? And how could taking a month off improve your health? So I'll give you a two-parter there.
Okay, great, Larry. Well, it's interesting because people do take advantage of it. So people do participate. I don't have numbers on Wisconsin right now, but we do see a number of people doing it. And some people only last a few days or a couple weeks. They might not make it through the whole month. But the point is that folks are trying to reexamine their relationship with alcohol. I'm on my third Dry January, and I find, you know, that it's personally helpful, but the data really speaks for itself. There's a number of benefits. You mentioned those a little bit in your open. Some folks experience some weight loss. People tend to eat a little bit better. They have more energy. And I think when you have just even a touch more energy, you're more likely to make that salad or, you know, kind of do that extra piece, maybe get a little bit more exercise in. People also report clearer skin. We know that it reduces blood sugar. And the big one is better sleep.
Yeah, better sleep.
People universally report that. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, you're director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project. I think it'd be worth it to talk a little about the goals of the project and what it's all about.
Well, thank you. The goals of the project are really to support communities and our state in reducing alcohol-related harms. So we do research. We look at existing research and think about what are the things that communities can do to, to create safer alcohol environments and to reduce alcohol-related harm. And so there's a number of things that communities can do, and even, you know, organizations and civic organizations can do in terms of kind of reducing the availability of alcohol. So reducing, like, you know, sometimes you go to an event, they have drink tickets. Maybe don't do the drink tickets, right? So when people have to pay for their own alcohol, they tend to drink a little bit less. We also help communities look at, you know, maybe they should run alcohol age compliance checks. So to make sure that retailers in their community aren't selling to underage people, which is illegal anyway. And we find that those can be very successful and very positive for everybody involved. We encourage folks to look at how many alcohol licenses that they have in a community, and is that kind of how they want that community to be in terms of, you know, it's kind of like everywhere you look, there seems to be alcohol sold or served in Wisconsin. And that sends a message to our kids and frankly to us, in terms of, you know, that we almost should be drinking, when I don't think that that's what we intended. And so I think being cautious about approving all these new licenses is an important step.
Jason emailed. He says, some people think that beer and wine can be used more often than hard liquor. Is that just wishful thinking?
That's a great question. And that is wishful thinking. Alcohol is alcohol is alcohol. Serving size matters. So when you look at standard serving sizes, it's really important to keep that in mind. That's like a 12-ounce beer at 5%. You've got wine, which is, I believe, 5 ounces. Sorry, I'm off the top of my head. And then, you know, it's like a regular size shot glass for liquor. We do find many products have many more than one serving in them. So it's one of those things that people should be cautious about. Sometimes, you know, you see those wine in a can or other drinks in a can, and they'll say there's 2 servings in there. So if you only want one, be sure to split that up.
Yeah. George in Wanakee has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, George.
Good morning, Larry, and hello, Maureen. I have a question for you, Maureen. You mentioned that the consumption of alcohol among the millennial generation is going down. I'm curious to know if you have any correlation between that and the consumption of THC-infused drinks that are widely available in our state now.
Interesting.
That's a great question. And we don't have data on the THC-infused drinks at this point. So I don't have an answer for that. We do know the alcohol consumption is going down. There is some trend data from time to time that does show increases in usage of THC over alcohol. But overall, alcohol is still the number one used drug in Wisconsin.
Yeah. George, thanks for calling. Elizabeth in Stevens Point, we'll give you a chance to join in.
Yes, hello.
Hi there.
Hi. Yes, I've been listening to the show, and I used to be a traffic safety instructor for Wisconsin. I taught the DUI classes. And I always had to explain to my students how much one drink was. Because, you know, they would think they could drink, you know, a big glass of wine or, one of the larger beers out of a can. I didn't know if you had mentioned, like, the quantity, like the 5 ounces or the 1 1/2 ounce in a mixed drink, which is important for people to know. So they know that, you know, if you have, like, 2 ounces of a hard liquor, that's really a little bit more than you should have.
Yeah. Thanks, Elizabeth. Comment on that, Maureen?
You're exactly right. serving size can be very tricky and really important to keep track of. So sometimes folks order a double at a restaurant, for example, and again, realizing that that's 2 drinks, and if it's not measured, it can be more than that. So it kind of depends on how the operator, operates that. So it is important. And we also find a lot of stuff that people are buying in cans or bottles have more than one serving size. So it can be almost deceiving, you know, when you have products like Four Loko or other products that look like an energy drink. Sometimes they have 3 or 4 or even 5 servings in a single can.
Boo.
So that really changes things.
I guess it would. There are a lot of terms, and this relates to an email. Binge drinking, heavy drinking, lots of terms that describe drinking. What's the difference between a binge drinker and a heavy drinker?
That's a great question. So what you're talking about is the definition of excessive alcohol use. So it's a technical term that the CDC defines, the Centers for Disease Control, in 4 ways. One is underage drinking. The other is drinking while pregnant. And then the heavy drinking is 1 to 2 drinks per day. And binge drinking is 4 to 5 drinks in about a 2 to 3 hour period. And the reason why that is defined in that way is when you have 4 to 5 drinks, depending if you're a man or a woman, you're generally at your 0.08 blood alcohol level. So you're intoxicated at that point.
I would think so. That's a fairly short period of time. Although I have to say, and this relates, I think, to strategies that you can use. Here's a personal example. I have once a week I get together with a bunch of friends, actually, and we get together at a local bar and restaurant for about an hour and a half, almost exactly an hour and a half every day, every time, once a week. But a while back, I decided, everybody has a beer usually, but I decided to go with the non-alcohol varieties of beer. Blue Moon, I happen to like. As a matter of fact, that non-alcohol, it's got like the taste of it. But anyway, I realized that when I switched that, it really didn't seem to make any difference to anybody else, any of my friends who were there, some who were drinking non-alcohol and some who weren't. Didn't seem to make any difference, and it seemed to me, I did not, because I had to drive, and I wasn't going to drive, so with alcohol, so I felt pretty good about myself. I had a good time anyway. Nobody else seemed to mind, and it was for me, it turned out to be a good thing. Now, I had a can in front of me, and it was beer-like, but there wasn't any alcohol in it.
Right, and we're finding that's more and more common. I have to applaud, you know, a lot of Madison restaurants and bars, and even around the state, that we see so many more options for folks, a much more extensive non-alcoholic menu. Of course, there's always water or soda, and those kinds of things, but we're definitely seeing many different varieties of non-alcoholic options, non-alcoholic cocktails, and those kinds of things. And I think that does, you know, if you enjoy the taste of something, you don't necessarily have to give that up, but you can either reduce or eliminate the alcohol factor. And I think it's becoming more and more the norm. So it's less, you know, people are feeling more comfortable around that. Although there are social circles where it's like, what, you're not having a drink? You know, and so sometimes I explain, I'm in dry January right now, or, you know, those kinds of things.
But there is something about having something that looks like what everybody else. I swear, there is something about that, having that can in front of you, or that cocktail, I guess. I rarely would have a cocktail anyway, regardless. There's something about having something that looks like what everybody else is drinking. Is that just me, or is it?
I think it's a social norm. You know, it's something that we're used to, especially in Wisconsin. I think in other parts of the country, you don't see that quite as much. But, you know, now we have so many more options, and so people should feel more comfortable, you know, taking part in that. Sometimes people may have a beer and then they might have a non-alcoholic drink, you know, and not, you know, not continue to have alcohol. So those are all good options.
So I'm wondering other kinds of strategies that we might use. And, you know, if you're sober curious, how do you approach social situations where you might actually be pressured to drink?
Well, I think there are a lot of reasons that people decide not to drink. Sometimes it's they're on some medication that may lead to that. Sometimes it's, you know, they really want to get some good sleep. You know, if they've got something, an event coming up or a presentation or, you know, those kinds of things that they want to be ready for. So it's, on the one hand, we really don't have to justify our reason for not drinking alcohol. But I do know that people often feel like they should. And so that's where, you know, thinking through what are your reasons, and better sleep is a big one that I think almost everybody understands.
Along with fewer trips to the bathroom during the evening. Getting yourself out of bed to go run to the bathroom more often. What is it about Wisconsin? I mean, we must be close to leading the nation in alcohol consumption.
We are in many aspects, not all, but many. And part of it is, you know, none of this happened overnight. This was kind of a slow evolution where we continued to allow more licenses than, you know, other states, for example. That we have made alcohol available in more places than most other states. You know, many states don't sell in gas stations, for example. We tend to have our festivals where alcohol can be carried around where again, in many other places, you have a fenced off area where people consume alcohol. So we've just made kind of these changes over time, and they've accumulated to where now alcohol is just, you know, available, it seems like, almost everywhere or at almost every event. And we've come to expect that, where when you travel outside of Wisconsin, you find that that is not the norm. And perhaps something that we should think about, kind of pulling that back a little bit, and making sure people have more opportunity to enjoy doing things with their family without alcohol being involved.
Yeah.
Again, that's an important message for kids, that they see their parents taking part in social activities without always having alcohol in their hands. And that, you know, in community groups, really thinking about, you know, we probably don't need to have alcohol, you know, where people could carry it around. Maybe, you know, think about doing the fenced off areas and checking for IDs to make sure kids aren't getting it. But also just creating a safer environment for everybody.
Yeah. You know, as you were talking, one other thing struck me. When I go to almost any other state, the cost is higher. And the taxes are on it, on alcohol, are seem to be, to me at least, to be quite a bit higher elsewhere.
So our beer tax is one of the lowest in the nation. I think we're tied maybe with Oklahoma. Don't quote me. but we have not raised our beer tax since 1969. On a bottle of a beer, it's, you know, much less than even a penny. So that definitely is part of it. Our taxes on wine and distilled spirits is a bit higher, but nowhere near where, for example, the Centers for Disease Control recommends to recoup the cost, the public cost of alcohol, which is more around $2 or so. Because we see the cost of binge drinking, excessive drinking, significantly first through our employers, but we also see it through our health system, through our justice system, through law enforcement, our courts. So many places it shows up when folks binge drink and there's harm to themselves or others.
Treatment options. We have, you know, we're getting up to the last minute or so, a minute and a half of the show. And I'm wondering about treatment. Somebody sitting listening to this and saying, you know what, I'm going to give it a try here and get rid of alcohol for a while or maybe forever. Where's the best place to go?
I think there's a few different places. First of all, your healthcare provider certainly is equipped and should be able to help you with that. The Department of Health Services has a great website that can also help. In terms of, you know, finding providers to help you with substance use. And these are really challenging things to do. So we strongly encourage you to engage with professionals in this area to help you with this. It's if this were easy,
yeah,
you know, it would be one thing, but it's not. And I think that's an important thing. If you feel like your alcohol use is, you're not in control of it, I think that's a really important conversation to have with your healthcare provider.
And I imagine you have some things on your website.
We have some. I would also refer you to the Department of Health Services. Our focus is on prevention.
Mm-hmm.
So, but, you know, the CDC has a great thing, and that is on our website. Check your drinking. And so it offers just a short kind of quiz about your alcohol use, and it can really help you understand, you know, whether or not there are things that maybe you should be thinking about.
Maureen, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for helping us get the year off on the right foot. I appreciate it very much. Thanks, Maureen.
Well, thank you. I appreciate the time.
Maureen Buzalaki is director of the Wisconsin Alcohol Policy Project at the Medical College of Wisconsin. So how's your circadian rhythm or your circadian clock? We're going to talk about that next with the author of a great new book. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. I'll tell you what, my guest and I were both bobbing our heads to that tune, The Syncopated Clock. Leroy Anderson was the composer of it, but I thought it was good music to get us going here as we talk about circadian rhythms. And we're talking about the book. It's titled The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. A fascinating book. I really had a lot of fun reading it. And our guest to tell us more about the importance of circadian rhythms, Lynn Peoples. Lynn is a science journalist from Seattle. She was an MIT Knight Science Journalist Fellow, holds master's degrees in biostatistics from the Harvard School of Public Health, and in science journalism from New York University. And as we talk with her, I want to hear from you. Let us know what you notice about your body and how it responds to changes in the clock, maybe around daylight savings time one way or the other. Or maybe you have trouble getting to sleep at night, wondering how screens or other light sources might be affecting your bedtime routine. Give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Lynn Peoples, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you, Larry. Happy to be here.
How many miles? Did you keep track of how many miles you put on in your exploration?
Oh, I totally should have. I mean, I can tell you a lot of jet lag was suffered over the course of researching the book.
I mean, you were in England, you were in New York, you were in, of course, Seattle, you were in, was it Arkansas?
Arkansas.
Alaska.
Yep, Denmark. Yeah. <That's>... it got around.
Certainly had to affect your circadian rhythm.
For sure.
But a lot of people usually think about it in terms of sleep. But what other daily functions do our circadian rhythms control?
Yeah, the real question is, what don't they control? It was really eye-opening to me as I dove into this subject that circadian rhythms really drive most every function of our body. Because the truth is, just about every cell of our body has a clock, right? And so all our organs, everything are from our metabolism to our defenses against invading pathogens to obviously our sleep cycles, everything is dictated by the clock. And so we've got these clocks. They're all trying to coordinate with each other to anticipate the right time of day to do things. And they're also trying to coordinate with the sun. Because these clocks don't tick at exactly 24 hours a day. That's where the circa and circadian comes from. It's about a day that these clocks tick on. And so, but to time things right for our body to live on this planet that has a 24-hour day, we need to keep everything in sync and keep in sync with the light and dark cycles that of this planet we live on. So that's where it's really driving and coordinating to make sure our body is efficient and doing those right things at the right times of day.
And you know what was really interesting to me as well is that all animals, insects, plants, all operate that way, right?
Yes, just about all of life that scientists have investigated so far evolved to have these clocks. So obviously they're important. They are useful to survival. And as humans, we evolved with them as well.
What made you start thinking about your own inner clock?
Yeah, you know, I really think subconsciously it had been, well, obviously it's driving things for all of us. But as somebody who grew up in Seattle, where we're at a really high latitude, I didn't quite realize it, but, you know, we're above you. We're above a lot of, like, big Canadian cities even. And at this latitude, the days, you know, really fluctuate throughout the year. Really long days, really short days. And like most places still today, in high school, we started at before 7:30 a.m. So, you know, for months of the year, I was going to school basically in the dark, leaving after sports practice in the dark. And I noticed, you know, this very obvious change in kind of my mood and my energy and throughout the course of the year, you know, summers versus winters, really different. And so, and I think, you know, I've always had sleep problems myself, struggled a lot with that growing up and continued as an adult. So these things were kind of going on in the background, but I didn't really think that much of it until I had moved back to Seattle after stints in Minnesota, which was actually really nice because the winters can be bright, like in Wisconsin with the sun reflecting off the snow. But I'd moved back to Seattle and I had visited this locker room of the Seattle Mariners, my hometown baseball team, and they had installed these new lights that you could adjust in intensity and color in the locker room. And the idea was to try to help the players' circadian rhythms, to energize them before games, to relax them after so they could sleep. And as this was being described to me, I remember thinking, whoa, you know, like, okay, this is what's driving them to do this, because, you know, these players are not getting maybe adequate light and dark. And, you know, if it's really going to energize them before the game, what could that do for me? Like, should I be thinking about this? Could this explain my, you know, my lifelong struggles?
And so that's probably why you decided to write this book.
Yes, exactly. That led me to write a one feature story on circadian lighting, which opened my eyes to so many other aspects of how circadian rhythms influence our well-being and our health. So I went down the circadian medicine rabbit hole next, and then it was just, I was all in.
Oh, man. Well, one part of the book that I found really interesting was when you spent 10 days in an underground bunker. Missile silo. You got to tell that story in the first place. How did you wind up there, and what was it, you know, so forth?
Yeah, so I was motivated as part of the book to try to experience for myself what happened. Well, A, what do my inner clocks really, like, what pace do they tick at? Because we're all our clocks are ticking a little differently. And that explains why there's some of us that are early birds and some are night owls and everything in between. So I wanted to get a sense of how do my clocks tick naturally without any cues? And then how, you know, what happens when they fall out of sync? So really I wanted to put myself in a space void of any input as to the 24-hour Earth day. So that's any daylight or anything else that's synced to that, right? So I cut myself off from other humans, like any media, and really any light, because light messes with our rhythms, as we might get to. So I was just searching far and wide. And on Airbnb, I found that this man had purchased a nuclear missile silo from the government. This had been used in the Cold War and sealed up for decades. But he popped it open and then spent many years souping it up into this luxurious Airbnb. And so I moved in for 10 days and we dimmed all the lights and only used red light, which is the color least likely to influence your circadian rhythms. So I lived under dim red light, decked out in a bunch of devices measuring everything from my heart rate to my temperature to my blood glucose levels. Didn't look at any clocks. And just try to live for 10 days and see what happened.
And it was, I mean, you had to tape over. Of course, there were all kinds of clocks and everything in this place that you had to.
Yep. It's amazing how many clocks are in our world. I didn't realize it until I was trying to avoid them, and they're everywhere.
And you kind of were synced in with some other folks, researchers, as part of this.
Yes. Yeah. Right, afterwards, yeah. So I collected all this data, and then some scientists helped me analyze that data and look at what happened to these various rhythms in my body. And yeah, sure enough, you know, a few days in, they started falling out of sync with each other and then falling out of sync with the 24-hour day. So my rhythms just drifted. And at one point, I was completely flipped. I was living my days when the people above ground were sleeping.
And isn't that how animals, you know, wild animals, they're more active at night?
Some, yeah, there are some nocturnal species. Yes, right. There's a lot of nocturnal species that are most active at night. And then there's crepuscular, you know, active at sunrise, sunset. We, you know, if you kind of step back and think about the evolution of this planet, different species were finding different niches, right? So, you know, some were going to be taking advantage of the daylight part of the Earth, you know, day-night, light-dark cycles. And then the other species were, you know, filling in at night. And so their physiology evolved to take advantage of those, you know, what circumstances they would be in at during those particular hours. And the clocks helped them out.
Our guest today, Lynn Peoples, her book is titled The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. A fascinating book. And you can join in with your own questions or comments as we move along. Number to call, 800-642-1234. Email to talk@WPR.org. And let's go to Glenn in Big Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Glenn. Thank you for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call and for the show. I'm wondering if your guest has looked at the proximity to the extreme edges of time zones and how that affects those populations. I've noticed that, you know, places that, like New York, is on the extreme eastern edge of the eastern time zone. I live on what would be the extreme western edge. And then it changes how the lengths of days sync up with the clock.
That is a really good question. And scientists have, and economists actually, have looked at some data to try to kind of tease out some of the differences. And in fact, I mean, as you're alluding to, the eastern side of a time zone, people there are being exposed to an earlier sunrise than on the western side, according to the, you know, the clock on the wall. Mm-hmm. And scientists have found that on the eastern edge of the time zone, people are, in fact, you know, on the whole, healthier. If you look at the data going from east to west within a time zone, cancer rates slightly increase. And also salaries start to decrease and longevity starts to decrease as you go from where the sun rises earlier to when where the sun rises later. Because our clocks really are counting on that morning light to keep calibrated and in sync. And if we're missing that, you know, that early morning light and that light's getting pushed later, as it does under daylight saving time, for example, then there's some evidence that, you know, health, there are health consequences of that.
Ah, interesting. Glenn, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. You can join in too, 800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Thanks for joining in today. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Lynn Peoples. She is the author of the book, The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. And again, invite you to join in. The number is 800-642-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. And just a reminder, if you missed part of our show or just want to hear it again, you can always go to our archive at WPR.org/Larry to hear recordings of all of our broadcasts going back a long, long way. Christina in Glenwood City has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Christina.
Hi there. Thank you. You mentioned that you had sleep challenges. Has this been resolved as a result of your research? And what advice do you have for those who do have challenges and follow good sleep hygiene? Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, great question. So it's an ongoing challenge for me, I will admit, but I have found some tools that definitely help. And I really have kind of broken it down to three really kind of core rules that I try my best to incorporate into my day-to-day to improve my sleep. And that is really finding contrast in my days, creating that contrast. So really trying to get my days bright, especially morning light, getting out for, you know, 20 minutes in the morning to walk to coffee if possible, or sitting on my balcony. I am fortunate to have a big window by my desk. So just trying to get as much light during the day as possible, and then really cutting the lights at night. Just trying to turn off, especially every overhead light, lights that have particularly blue wavelengths of light, you really want to try to cut out. And I use these electric candles around my apartment to just kind of create a nice warm glow. So it's really, yeah, the light and dark contrast. And then constricting my meal times as much as possible throughout the day to try to limit, because when we evolved really to eat during daylight hours. And so the science is really pointing to, in particular, the importance of cutting off any incoming calories a few hours before bed. And I find when I do that, I really do sleep a lot better. Just like 3 hours before bed, if I can not take in any, you know, sips of wine or any bites of, you know, chips or anything like that. Just sometimes hard to do to have a social life. And then finally, consistency. So if I can try to, you know, get up and go to bed at a similar time every night, it's so much easier to fall asleep and wake up at, you know, those times. So when I'm able to incorporate those three rules, I do find that my sleep problems are much resolved. But it's, you know, it's hard on our in society today, and you know, balance the social life and balance all these things.
We have light a lot. I mean,
yes.
Our society, I mean, we're under light many more hours than, say, an animal in the wild might be.
Right, unless they're exposed to the light pollution. So we're actually, our light's invading their environments as well. But that is totally true. I mean, right, walk outside, our especially the new LED streetlights are very bright. You know, walk into a store and those grocery store lights are just really, you know, glaring. And then, you know, I'm, you know, more cognizant now, obviously, after doing all this research. But, you know, I walk into my dad's house or a friend's home, and now I just, those overhead lights seem so bright to me. But that's, yeah, it's what we, most of us are used to. So we have lights, we're exposed to artificial light many more hours of the day than if we were, say, camping.
Marty in Whitewater, your turn. Hi, Marty.
Good morning, good afternoon, rather. Thank you for taking my call. Circadian rhythms, is there any correlation between that and seasonal affective disorder? And I'll list it off air. Thank you.
All right, thank you for calling.
Yeah, good question. Absolutely. There is a lot of research that has looked into the role of circadian rhythms and your being predisposed to seasonal affective disorder. So the rates of SAD are higher at higher latitudes, perhaps not surprising when you think about, you know, people I talk to in Alaska where the days get really, really short in the winter and really long in the summer. And those throw the circadian, you know, really confuse circadian rhythms. So there's ample evidence, and this is also pointing to potential tools that people can use if they're prone to the effects in the wintertime. And that's, you know, trying to make use of these sun lamps or other bright light that can, as closely as possible, mimic the sun. If you expose yourself to that in the morning for a particular amount of time, you know, usually they come with these lights will come with instructions, then that can kind of make up for the fact that it might still be dark outside and help reset your inner clocks as they were, you know, evolved really to anticipate that light in the morning. Because it's, you know, it wasn't that long ago that we migrated north and south. So there's certain populations with the genetics that might help them a little more at those extreme latitudes. And there's others of us that perhaps aren't quite ready for that. And so we might need to sort of trick our clocks in a way to give them the light in the dark, a little closer to the 12 hours a day that where we initially evolved at the equator.
So in the morning, the alarm clock for me goes off, my phone goes off at 5:40. And then I get up and then I go a couple, 3 miles through the neighborhood. I usually don't want to get up, to be honest. But then once I get up, I'm fine. And it's more fun in the summer, although this morning when I was out, You know, we had a full moon, and Mars was just to kind of lower right of the moon. And so, and I was running along the lake, and there were lights across the lake that were pretty attractive. But I'm sure I'm going against my own probably circadian rhythm, because if we need an alarm clock, we're probably, as you well point out in your book, we're probably not in our rhythm. I have to do it because, I like to do it, but also because, there's a time constraint. I have to do my time outdoors, come back, take a shower, and then go to work.
Right. And do you do that same, routine 7 days a week? Do you get up at the same time when you're not working?
Probably not. On the average, it might be more like six.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, I think that the key test, if you're living according to your inner clocks, is, as you suggested, are you using an alarm clock? If you're waking up to your alarm clock, that's not when your body wants to wake up. But that's the case for most of us. Most of us have to, abide by some forced schedule on our lives. And the only way to really tell what your inner clocks really want to do naturally is to, shut off the alarm clock and basically to go on vacation. It takes a few days, but if you can let yourself just go and live according to what your body's telling you to do, when to fall asleep, when to wake up, and then when during the day do you have, the energy to go for a run, like you said, or to do various things. All these inclinations, all these particular, strengths throughout the day will ebb and flow.
Yeah, and I think you're right, because I was on vacation for a week. Well, it's, with the weekend days, it was 9 days. And I turned my clock off. And I did wake up early, but not quite as early as 5:40 every morning. And then I fell into what you call the Netflix effect, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Right. So, our clocks are somewhat malleable. So, we have this genetic predisposition based on the way our clocks tick to rise and, sleep at certain times of day, et cetera. But those, because they're, only about 24 hours and respond to light and dark and these various inputs, we can kind of train them. So the fact that you still wake up, reasonably early, you have kind of, indeed trained your clock. So you've shifted a little bit. And then, this Netflix effect can happen. So because of the power of these inputs, if you, say, stay up late, expose yourself to artificial light, watch a Netflix show, stimulating the brain into a later hour, then, wake up a little later, miss the morning light, it can essentially snowball. So then the next night, maybe you're up even later and, under artificial light. And this can just, stack up and really put you out of sync.
Yeah, it can indeed. Craig had emailed back to Alaska for a minute, wondering if you went during extreme darkness or extreme sunlight, and you were there for extreme sunlight.
Yeah, I was
talking about that experience. It sounded great in a lot of ways.
It certainly was a nicer experience than being in a bunker without any light. I did a long weekend camping under the midnight sun. So the sun would set where I was in Denali National Park at this particular time, but it never got dark. So it's, barely dipped below the horizon, then popped kind of right back up. And I was there with a bunch of folks that lived in Anchorage in the surrounding area. So this was their reality, they lived there and went through the seasons. And they were telling me about how they basically felt kind of this manic, manic, depressive or bipolar moods throughout the year. And in the summer, during our trip, it was more of that manic. It's just you got to soak up every minute of sun while you got it. And you're energized. And I felt that. My sleep was horrible. It's really hard to sleep in a tent when doesn't get dark. But that sun has this energizing effect. So light does more to us than just affect our rhythms. You know, it has, as we probably know intuitively, it's energizing, directly energizing, and has these other impacts that actually scientists are still exploring, which is fascinating. But that kind of compensated a little bit for my lack of sleep. So it was a lot of fun. It's definitely, I came back and just needed to sleep for a long time. But yeah, very different than being underground for 10 days, for sure.
One little aside that you had in the book relating to that was the change from light to dark and dark to light is very fast in Alaska.
Yes. Right. Those transition weeks, right, where in the spring, where in the days are lengthening, and in the fall, and the days are shortening. I spoke with a sleep doctor in Fairbanks on my way to Denali. And he was talking about those were the periods of time where he actually saw the most patients with sleep troubles and other, depression and various disorders that could be related to circadian rhythms. And indeed, I mean, we didn't evolve at these high latitudes. And so that quick change is really confusing our clocks, because our clocks, so they don't just serve as a daily clock, but they also serve as calendars. So as those days shrink, as we have, you know, varying inputs of light throughout the day, as those timings shift, that's telling our body that, oh, you know, spring is approaching or summer is approaching. And you could think how important this would be for a lot of species for when they're mating, when they might be migrating. So evolutionarily, yeah, these clocks serve a lot of purposes. And one is that calendar, and humans, you know, there's some effects here still, and it's very confusing when that's happening really, really rapidly.
Yeah.
And
you noted that violence, or even domestic violence,
yes,
jumps in Alaska during those couple of times when the changes occur.
Yes, that is what the sleep doctor had found, yep.
Mert emailed, what impact does not having a window in your office have on your circadian rhythm? And you do spend a fair amount of time in a chapter or two on offices and working. Somebody else, Todd, had emailed and wondering, what about workers on rotating schedules is another one we can take up. But what impact does not having a window in your office first have on your circadian rhythm?
Yeah, not having a window just makes it really tough for the body to know that it's daytime. I mean, that, you know, goes back to the importance of having that contrast, that really light day and that dark night. So again, I'm fortunate I have a window here. A lot of people are not. And you can think about the inequities that come up here too, because there's probably certain segments of the population that are most likely do not have access to that window corner office, right? You know, they might be working in a basement or a back of the house space or a warehouse. And so without that access to that bright blue rich light that the sun gives, the body is struggling to know that it's daytime and doing, you know, anticipating the activities that it needs to do during the daytime. Now, as we understand the importance of this, scientists are developing better artificial lights that are closer mimics of the sun that could be installed in some of these offices that can help.
And as long as we're on windows for a minute, you had a really interesting chapter, I thought, on England. You tell a little history of England, and there was a tax on windows.
Right. Yeah. Some centuries ago, they did use a tax on windows as a proxy for income tax, because you could think about, you know, a larger home, a richer family would have more windows, right? But people tried to get around this by bricking up their windows. And as I learned, you know, landlords would do this. So again, poor families, you know, may lose their windows as they were trying to evade taxes. So there was, there was a period of time in which daylight was cut off to a large extent in a lot of these homes, just to cut down on taxes. And finally, enough people were kind of adamant about the importance of both light and air, because obviously if you cut off a window, you're not getting a lot of fresh air coming in, and they ultimately lifted the tax. But I got to see firsthand. I walked around London and saw some of these relics, some old bricked up windows. They're still out there.
And the first alarm clock was actually a person.
Yes, before we had our alarm clocks on our nightstands or our phones, there were human alarm clocks. So I learned about what were called knocker uppers. Yes, and they would walk the streets with a pipe in which they blew dried peas at people's bedroom windows to wake them up in the morning. So you think this is about the time that, you know, factories started employing workers and, you know, they'd start at really early hours and yeah, how are they going to wake up to get to work on time? So they would hire somebody to wake them, to knock them up. And the little, you know, dried peas would rattle and wake them up. And then in some places, I mean, it was amusing. And in Italy, they had what were called hooters that would blow these really loud, shrieky whistles to wake people up.
So you had knocker-uppers and hooters. And the hooters got into trouble because the neighbors, who might not be happy to get up at that time.
They would wake them up too. Or, you know, if you know, for the hooter themselves, they didn't want that to happen because they wanted all the money they could get. They want to, you know, they don't want to just blow one whistle to wake everybody up. They want to, you know, get paid for each customer. So
also a problem. You were getting at a little bit, and you spend some time on this, on the class problems that can be associated with buildings and structures. You mentioned Japan. There's a right to sunshine law that governs the height and shape of buildings. But I know you zeroed in on New York, but other. Large cities have similar. Just describe that a little bit.
Yeah, this really kind of stood out to me as I was doing my travels. I mean, there's really, well, I mean, step back. You think about food deserts, right? A lot of us have heard of that. There's particular neighborhoods where it's hard to get access to healthy food. And there also appears to be, you know, daylight deserts. And you can also think of darkness deserts, because again, we need daylight during the day, darkness at night. And, you know, poor families, certain segments of the population are more apt to be living in, say, basement apartments, you know, in the shadows of, especially in urban areas, you know, living in the shadows during the day, working in spaces, again, without access to daylight, without a window. And then at night, these are the same people that might be more prone to artificial light, this light pollution that's, you know, creeping into their bedrooms. So maybe they're living in a public housing project, which I walked through a few in both New York and London, where they have these massively bright LED, you know, lights up around, including like there's police floodlights in some areas, you know, to increase safety, right? That was the motivation for these, because there might be higher crime rates. And indeed, you know, there's people also probably lack blackout curtains to block out that light. And so they may not realize it, but this is, you know, impacting their sleep. And, you know, there's another factor that's perpetuating the inequities.
Even in Central Park, I think, along the edge of Central Park, you mentioned the high rise.
Yeah, these towers going up and casting shadows into public spaces. And yeah, there's talk about for, you know, little public parks or schoolyards where these big buildings are casting shadows. So kids are, you know, maybe not getting daylight while they're outdoors. Yeah.
Amazing stuff. You bring in so many different aspects of all this in your book. It's really a pleasure to read and to learn about. Lynn Peoples, our guest, her book is The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. And you can join in, too. Questions, give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Talking with Lynn Peoples about her book, the main title, The Inner Clock. It's great to have her with us. Questions as we talk about circadian rhythms? What about yours? Give a call. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Doug in Barnes, Wisconsin, has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Doug.
Hello. I was wondering if your guest would care to comment on changing daylight savings time. People seem to get rather wound up about it twice a year. And yet, I guess an observation that I would make is that while they want to maybe do away with daylight savings time, at the same time, people seem to have no qualms at all about traveling across time zones, either for work or for vacations, perhaps even just to spend a weekend. So in my mind, I'm wondering if we can survive that, if it really makes it that much difference, whether we would revert back. Other than, I think, for most people, it's the convenience of not having to change their clocks.
All right. Doug, thanks for calling. What do you think, Lynn? You spend a fair amount of time on that in your book.
Right. It's definitely something, you're right, that people have kind of gotten wound up about, winding our clocks forward and back, I guess. So the science really points to, if we want to lock the clock one way or another, I think the popular opinion is leaning still slightly towards going permanent daylight saving time. The science suggests that standard time is far healthier for our rhythms and everything they dictate for our bodies. And that's because taking that hour of morning light and putting it at the end of the day, which is what daylight saving time does, is kind of doing the opposite of what our rhythms want, right? We want that morning light and we want that nighttime darkness. And to your point, I mean, so I guess there's two issues with daylight saving time, and there's that acute effect of that hour loss, or that hour shift, twice a year. And sure, there's slight increases scientists have found in like car accidents and heart attacks immediately after that change, particularly in the spring forward, that day, that week after we spring forward. But it is somewhat a slight change. And you're right. I mean, people do accumulate more jet lag than even just that hour as we travel. But really the big issue at stake here, I think, is that long-term thinking about that hour shift. And now our bodies are kind of, an hour out of alignment from the day-night cycle of on our planet. So that's where scientists are really kind of keyed in on. And that's why they're like really cautioning against trying to go on permanent daylight saving time. And I know personally in Seattle, if we were on daylight saving time in the winter, the sun wouldn't rise until like 9 o'clock for some portion of the winter. And when you think about kids going to school, at 7 o'clock, and it's, there's a lot of ripple effects that we should be thinking about.
And there have been some schools, by the way, that, as you write mm-hmm. about in the book, that have changed their times.
Yes, right. Minnesota, I believe, was kind of one of the leaders. Some districts there shifted. So middle and high school, this is what we're really thinking about. So in general, when you hit adolescence, your circadian rhythms drift a little later. So this is a good part of why teens have trouble getting up early and going to bed early. And that's because of their biology as well as some societal factors. But if you were forcing in general, or, at least in previous decades, we've been forcing these adolescents to get up even earlier for middle and high school than they were in elementary school. Some districts now are flipping that. So they're having elementary schools start earlier and middle and high schools start later, which is more in line with biology.
And it seems to, and there were some results that were actually the students themselves were doing better.
Yeah, some studies have followed up, looked at before and after these time changes, including in Seattle. Seattle Public Schools made a change just about a decade ago almost now. And indeed, they found, kids are sleeping more, test scores are improving. So, yeah, there's evidence now that this is definitely beneficial. And if you think about this, I mean, sleep is really important for all of us, really important as you're still growing. And truncating sleep, if you're forcing a kid to get up too early, you're particularly cutting off some of their REM sleep, which happens at the end of the sleep cycle. And that is critically important to like solidifying memories and to, controlling their behavior, because, you want that brain functioning well in adolescence in particular when, these kids might be more vulnerable to certain things.
Doug, thank you for your question. Todd emailed, and this goes back to something I started to ask you about earlier and mm-hmm. then we didn't follow up on, how can workers on rotating schedules adapt their circadian rhythms to minimize fatigue and improve overall health?
Yeah, that is a really big challenge. Yeah, good question. So there are various, you know, types of shift work. You got your night shifters, you got your, and these rotating shift workers are probably at the, you know, face the greatest challenges. So the one idea that the scientists brought up to me, who's really, you know, focused in on this, is because on average, our circadian rhythms are a little longer than 24 hours. If you are on a rotating schedule, I mean, hopefully your employer or whoever is setting the schedule is, if they're doing rotating shifts, you know, shifting your shift a little later each day. Because if your rhythms are a little longer, that means it's going to be a little easier, you know, to stay up a little later, stay up a little later. And then if you're, you know, flipping back and forth, the idea is to try to minimize that whiplash you're giving to your body. So if you're on a, you know, a day shift one day and then on a night shift another day, try to, you know, shift or try to move your sleep times and your wake up times a little closer to each other. So they're not quite so extreme. So maybe that does mean sleeping in on the weekends, right? If you're going to be doing a night shift, so you're just the most you can minimize that whiplash, the better. But on the whole, it's tough. Where, you know, consistency is really important for our circadian rhythms and all they run in our body. So, but there are things you can do.
there was another piece that I found really interesting. Well, I found all of it interesting, but you get into a bit about athletes. And, you know, now in this day and age where we're traveling across the country here, the Big Ten is now from one coast to the other coast, as right. an example. And what is the impact of that for a team like the, well, let's say Rutgers, which is way over on the East Coast, and then they've got to go play UCLA or Oregon or Washington on the other coast, and, of course, vice versa.
Right. Yeah. I find this really interesting and really.
There was a guy who really got into that, and you talk about sort of he really got into the numbers on that.
Yeah. Right. I mean, so, you know, I grew up, obviously, I've mentioned the Mariners. I grew up a Seattle sports fan, and I was talking to this guy in Portland who also is a fan of Seattle sports as well as Portland sports. And he dove into data that was looking at the NBA. During COVID, when they went into a bubble in Disney World to play for the playoffs. So that essentially removed all these excess factors of time zones and jet lag, right? And you look to see how did those players perform relative to each other and then relative to before the pandemic. And sure enough, you know, the bubble really leveled the playing field because, as he's found and some other scientists I've talked to, our bodies, again, everything's on a rhythm, and on average, our athletic performance peaks in the late afternoon or early evening. So if you have a team from the East Coast flying to the West Coast for a competition, let's say it's NFL football and the kickoff is at 1 p.m., right? So maybe you have, yeah, the New York Giants or something, or flying into Seattle. At 1 p.m. in Seattle, their inner clocks are still ticking at about 4 p.m., right? Because they're East Coast time. That is about the start of, on average, peak athletic performance. Whereas the Seattle team is kind of on their midday slump. And so there's an uneven playing field there you could think about. So so now, yeah, like you said, we have these college athletic conferences forcing these players to travel across time zones. So A, you've got more of a factor of jet lag, more hours, you know, away from school. And then plus perhaps, you know, less equity in circadian clocks and circadian performance, which is not something that was probably considered when these decisions were made.
Well, it is interesting. I thought back to a long time back to 1993 when the Badgers football team was playing a game in Japan.
Huh.
against Michigan State, and it was a year, and it was kind of a bowl game. The Badgers actually also played in the Rose Bowl that year or that season, but Barry Alvarez, who was the coach, talked to a sleep specialist professor here at the university, and he had time because they knew it was coming. And I forget how it actually worked, but the guy had suggested that the players fall asleep a half hour earlier each night for I forget how many nights. But anyway, and it turned out that both teams were flying on the same plane to Japan. And Barry Alvarez said he walked through the plane at one point, and all the Michigan State players were asleep, and all the Badger players were awake. And he said he knew right then that the Badgers were gonna win the game.
And they won. I'm guessing.
And they won.
All right. Yes. Oh, he was ahead of his time. And yes, there are now chrono coaches out there helping teams to do various things just like that. Yeah, just ahead of travel, which we can all take advantage of if we're like facing, you know, potential jet lag on vacation. And then using light, you know, strategically timed bright blue light, and then blue light blocking glasses at other times to help kind of more rapidly change your rhythms to line up with your destination time zone. So a lot of tools.
Yeah. Didn't you give a lamp to a friend who was going on a submarine or something?
Right. It was a Coast Guard icebreaker that was headed to the Arctic. Yeah. So basically the same thing, because that, you know, at some point as they're headed north, well, there was no more light. The sun set and it didn't come back up. So I was hoping that sun lamp would kind of help him again trick his clocks into creating a day. And you know, anecdotally, end of one, but he found indeed that it helped. It helped his sleep, it helped his mood, it's helped his productivity. And I mean, the science does support this notion.
I thought it was funny too, because there were a couple of other lamps that had been given to other crew members as jokes, but it turned out they wound up using them. Anyway, you do talk about a link between circadian rhythms and Alzheimer's.
Yes. Among other chronic diseases, scientists are honing in on links. And it's looking, as far as dementia, Alzheimer's, cognitive decline, it's looking like it probably a two-way street, where the damaged part of the brain in Alzheimer's is actually, you know, touching or basically part of what is helping to drive circadian rhythms. So A. And then B, there's evidence to suggest that as our circadian rhythms weaken as we age, that could be, and if you know, if you have more disruption, that could be driving a more rapid pace at which you have, you know, the beta amyloid plaques, you know, building up in the brain. So there's a lot more research underway right now to really sort that out. We don't totally understand, but it looks like this two-way street, which is also pointing to maybe some new potential preventative strategies or ways to minimize some of the effects of Alzheimer's.
Yeah. So what do you, here we are getting out of time. What do you hope people take away with them after reading your book, The Inner Clock? I mean, it was really entertaining to begin with, but what do you hope people take away?
Yeah, I mean, I hope it's kind of an eye-opener to these kind of subtle effects that are happening inside of you, but having these profound effects on how your, you know, how your day-to-days are going, and then your long-term health and productivity. So I think there's, you know, things individuals can do, you know, again, you know, that contrast, that constricting meal times, and that consistency, kind of the three C's. So as individuals, we can do that to help our rhythms. And then broadly, thinking about as a society, what are some relatively low-hanging fruit that we can, ideas that we can implement to help everyone? And, you know, thinking about the equity concerns, thinking about daylight saving time, school start times, how we draw time zones, like all these things could potentially affect, you know, population-wide health.
Well, it's a great book. And Lynn, thank you so much for writing it. Let me know the next book you write, and we'll get you back whatever it is. Thanks so much.
I really appreciate it, Larry. Thank you.
Lynn Peoples, her book is The Inner Clock, Living in Sync with Our Circadian Rhythms. Really fascinating. We didn't get into, we just touched the surface with her book. And so you'll learn a lot more if you read it. Stay with us. I'm Larry Mealer.